Yeah.
Maybe one of these real quick. It's going to have two sections like the first quiz did. The first 10 of these, I'll be giving you the information and you give me the form. The last 5, I'll give you the form and you give me the information. So. And I should add, in this first section of 10, it's conceivable that there may not be a form that exists for it. In other words, it might have been a blank on the chart. So the blank is saying none. A little bit. So your answer might be zero, you know, none.
Amen.
these last five, you need to give the tenth voice root verb in the dictionary form and meaning. Number two here, where I have a dash in the beginning, it's one of those that's normally a compound. And for the root verb, you can just put the same thing with a dash in whatever form it is. For the meaning of that root verb, just give the meaning of the most common form, the one that's the most common variant that's given there.
just 5 in the second part.
Yeah. Just 10 in the first part, 5 in the second. Yes?
Jim.
Well, yeah, it's because it's never really the beginning of the word. I think they omitted, let me check. See the way they printed it. Technically, you need a breathing mark on it of some sort if it's going to begin a word like that, but... Yeah, it should have a rough breathing. But in any practical situation, there won't be any breathing mark there, because there'll be a prepositional prefix to the word. Thank you. Well, you're not finished? Okay, let's go ahead and exchange papers and correct them then. Now, point values on this one. Each of the two sections is worth 20 points. The first one, where you're using the form, We'll take off a point for every spelling error, half point for breathing mark. And there's a total of 2 possible on each of these first 10. So it'll be a total of 20 points in that section. The last section will have 4 points each. But we'll get into that a little bit. Each one of them is worth 4, so there's a point for each. How do they do that? Yeah, that's right. A point for each piece of information. Okay. Starting here, again, a spelling error, a letter wrong, and so forth, is 1 point off, up to a maximum of 2, so you can't miss too much and still come out of it. Okay. Aorist active, a vocal snake go should be a pethanon. We're not scoring on the accent, so. But you do lose a half point for breathing mark. It's wrong.
It's being alpha.
Oh, how did I do that? I'm sorry. Okay. A pethanone.
Yeah, minus 1 for me.
Everybody gets 1 extra. You put it in the form without the oppo, not even if there isn't an oppo.
Okay, that might have been a little confusing.
Otherwise,
that's
correct.
So. Yeah, the ethanol there. Then.
Yeah.
Okay. Just put a little pressure mark and note on there. Can anybody else do that on that particular verb? There's a little bit of confusion as to which way to go on some of these. Just leave a question mark. I'll see what we'll do on that. Okay, perfect middle passes of Caparizzo should be. Check that there is fine. Get that there is my. Okay, future active of Crino is Crino. Just change the accent.
Maybe you want the accent on that.
Yeah, that one we probably better have it because it's count 1 point for the accent on that one because that's the only thing that changes the form. Should be legalistic on that one. Okay, so if the accent's in the wrong place, it's a point off. Okay, the fourth one's easy. There's no form. Perfect middle path of this they mean doesn't exist. So you should just have nothing there. If you have something there, it's 2 points off. Okay. So that's a big 0 here. Okay, then the aorist active of Catharizzo should be Ekatherissa.
You know, the book that the author sometimes falls within.
An alpha instead of an epsilon?
Yeah.
Yes. There's a note there. So if you had an alpha there, if you wanted to be take the variation on that, that'd be fine. Ekatherissa or Ekatharissa. Okay, aorist active of Za'o should be Ezesa. And don't worry about accents in any of these forms except for Kruno there, as they said. Perfect active of histemi is Hesteka. Let's see. Well, I think I'll just write these down here. We had rough breathing on that one. Yep, Hesteka. Half one in the breathing. That print gets pretty small sometimes too. That's right, to see it. Okay, future active of fellow should be Feleso. Feleso. And the perfect active of Crino should be Kekrika. Kappa S1, Kappa Rho. Iota Kappa Alpha. And the aorist passive of Za'o doesn't exist. That should be nothing there, too. Okay, so there's 2 points for each one of those, 20 points possible there. 1 point for spelling error, half point for breathing mark. Now, in this last section, there's going to be 4 points possible for each one. One point for each piece of information. Okay, so you need to give the tense, the voice, the root verb, meaning the dictionary form. Now, as far as spelling of the root verb form is concerned, the whole thing's worth 1 point. If there's a spelling error in it, take a half point off. But if there's so many spelling errors that you can't recognize it, take a full point off. Or more than 1 spelling error, basically. Okay, so Kikrumai should be the perfect middle passive. Now, I don't say that. I just tell you that information. I'll write out the root word, though, from crypto. Perfect middle of passive from crypto, meaning to hide. So you can have crypto, and they do give you crubo also. So I guess I'll accept that as well.
It's in combination.
We'll give you some more dash. Okay. So crypto meaning to hide. You gotta draw the line someplace. Has to show a little mercy. Okay. And the heka here is the perfect active from hiemi. And hiemi doesn't mean anything by itself. So if you use off hiemi, that means to leave or forgive. So hiemi, you can just put that down and then put either write off hiemi out again or just say to leave or forgive. The meaning for this. The most common combination.
That was what? Perfect active.
Perfect active. Okay, a clay thing is the aorist passive of kaleo, to call. Apectena, aorist active of apocteno, to kill. To kill. And kopso is future active of kopto, to cut. Okay, those are worth 4 points each for a total of 20. So the total test is worth 40 points. Yes? They didn't put the off there? No, that's fine. I just told them to put the meaning of the meaning will come when they have to rewrite it. That'll be fine. Technically, it's incorrect, but it's kind of convention we adopted there. Okay, subtract the number of points from 40 and score the paper, return to the owner, and take a look at your paper, make sure everything's okay, correction wise. And then when you are satisfied, you can turn them into the front. For the next one, next section of these, for our next quiz, we'll make it 2 weeks from today. It'll be the rest of those on that same page. I'll give you the specific details in a moment here. The next quiz on this will be we left off of Cateno there, Apocteno. We'll pick up with Lambano and go to the bottom of the page to Peso. From Lambano to Peso there. So it's just picking up when we're left off and finishing out that page only. And let's see here. As far as complications, we've got mellow there. Notice that the imperfect is stated there, so you'll be responsible for the imperfect of mellow. It's got an irregular imperfect. And for oida, they don't give you actual forms here. They refer you back to page 370, or section 372, which is on page 293. And oida is peculiar in that it uses perfect forms for present meaning. So there aren't any present forms per se. So on this one, why don't you go ahead and write in, or maybe to a note to the side or something, because it is such an important verb, I do want you to be familiar with it. The present form is oida. And just mark that as present. In other words, even though it's perfect in form, just consider that your present one. Present is oida, and past, I suppose we can include it for the aorist or something, I don't know. Let's just put it this way. For oida, I'll just indicate it, if I give it to you in the test, I'll just say present, past, or future. The present is oida, the past is adane, which is a pluperfect form technically, and the future is adeso. They also give you the subjunctive there, but we're not going to worry about subjunctive because the rest of these are, you know, subjunctive is built on these other forms. So oida, adane, and adeso, those three forms you should be familiar with. Just your first person singular forms of the present, past, and future. And we'll just mark them like that, present, past, and future, just the way they've indicated it.
Okay.
2 weeks from today, what does that turn out to be?
March.
14th of March, okay?
Huh?
I think we do, don't we? We have Hebrew quiz that day, don't we? Maybe we better make it Wednesday. Huh? That's the grammar, isn't it?
The grammar, yeah.
That's the grammar one. That's the big one. Well, let's see. We could push this off. We could put it the Tuesday following if you want. Does anybody in the Greek class object to that, having a little bit longer? Let's make it the Tuesday following that. No. Yeah. It's a pretty rare thing. Okay. So let's make it Tuesday. What date does that turn out to be? What, the 19th? Okay, I better write that down someplace. Okay. Tuesday, March 19th. Okay. Any other questions on what's
on the form of alumni?
Yes. On that one, let's just kind of do it the way we've been doing these others. Just learn the forms as they are there with the dash, and then for meaning, use apolumi, destroy, whenever asked for meaning for it. I'm not sure if there's any other real common compounds. He says it destroys the usual compound. It's the only one I'm familiar with. Horao also has an imperfect that's irregular. Note that. Oron. Yes, Mark, did you have something?
That was my question.
Okay, yeah. Now, whenever they've got one of these imperfects, it's irregular. There aren't very many that are like that, but I do want you to be familiar with it. Okay, great.
I took a look in for he and me.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed one time before we had a verb like that, but it had a meaning within itself. And Strong said that the word meant to descend, and it was an intensive of a the apparently to come.
Oh, descend, you say? Or?
To sin.
To sin. Oh, to send. Okay. To send. Okay.
Like send away. And so, you know, I don't know. I know it's not used in the Greek New Testament.
Right.
Apparently, it's got some kind of meaning.
It possibly has even in the classical. You know, you might check in the classical and see if it's used all by itself there, and then got some prepositional additions later on. Okay, that's interesting. All right. Any other questions or comments there? Do I have all the papers? All right, let's go back to our diagramming then, see if we can crank in the last few details and start to have some fun with it. Yep. Right, exactly. Like one brother said, it's just like the University of Washington almost, and then you get lots of information thick and fast here. But that's good for you. You can chew on for a while here. And it's really not, when you get all this detail, you know, all of a sudden like this, it may be a little cumbersome. But once you start working with it and start doing some diagramming and so forth, hopefully it will start to make some sense. Okay. Hopefully.
Is it new?
We're going to
diagram like this both in Latin?
Oh, I would assume you can do it with any language. I don't know, you know, that there's... Has anybody here had Latin that's done any diagramming with it? I think we did some diagramming with German when I was in high school, a little bit, but not that much. You know, it does help to see what we're interested in. The reason we're taking... diagramming sentences, you know, it's good to know how to do it, but it's not that often that we're really pressed. But when we're dealing with something that's in the scriptures and it's inspired by the Holy Spirit, and we're interested in the way things are fitting together, we want to be real careful with it. It serves a purpose there to really help us to see what's going on. Yeah.
I think diagram is a whole
pathway
teaching.
Oh yeah, that kind of.
Interested.
No, exactly. Exactly.
It doesn't tickle
the flesh. I know. I when I was in English, you know, in high school, wherever. Junior high, I can't remember how long ago it was, when we did diagramming. It was always one of the most fun things to me. Of course, I was mathematically inclined, so, and I wasn't too thrilled about English, but I was interested in the mathematics, so once we got it in a kind of a mathematical mode, my interest perked up considerably. So, But for our purposes here, for exegesis, and since we're interested in detailed exegesis, this is going to be really handy for you. And it's good to, you know, have as many ways to picture something as possible. One of the reasons the diagramming to me is so appropriate for Greek is that Greek is such a graphic and pictorial type of language in terms of the prepositional relationships. There seems to be a real emphasis on spatial kind of relationships and the way things are fit together with your rules of concord and all these other things. And especially because of the fact that also it doesn't rely on word order as much. It relies on these grammatical devices to tie things together. It makes it very appropriate to put in a diagram. You know, the words are all scrambled up anyway, so you're not seeing them much more scrambled up in a diagram than you are in the text. And at least here you can see the connections. And it's forcing your mind to begin to observe the connections. Not that I expect you to begin to, you know, diagramming all of the Bible now. That's not really what we're trying to do. But when you run into a complicated exegesis and you're having some difficulty with it, it might be helpful for you to diagram the whole thing out and really begin to look at it. Especially if you're comparing certain passages with other passages, the relationship of certain clauses in one passage of Scripture to the same relationship in another passage, it's going to be really helpful. And also to solidify all the grammatical rules that you've learned. It's helpful in that respect. So, we were looking last time at some more of the details here. I think we talked about the infinitive marker and the appositive marker. It was just an equal sign with a shelf there for the appositive on one side or the other, depending on whether it's on the subject or on the object. The omission marker is the next category here. And that's where you're omitting something, a small x placed in the space where a grammatical element is not expressed. It's what we call an omission marker. And you can also put the missing part in parentheses as an option. If you know what the missing part is, if it's really clear from the context, what is to be understood there. Oftentimes they won't repeat things, you know, because it's already understood. You can go ahead and put in parentheses the missing part. Or if you don't know what the missing part is, but you know that something's missing, you can put an X there. And so in the case, this is often the case when you have, say, a verb with no subject. Since the verb itself contains the pronominal element for a subject in the form itself, then you needn't have a subject. For example, if it's a me or something, you can put an X over here, or you could put in parentheses that go, you know, as the understood subject. So that's what we mean by the omission marker. Now, it's used, as I said, when the subject is omitted because it's included in the verb. It's also used if the verb is missing because it's self-evident from the context. Often if it's a copulative verb, an equative verb, in predicate structures and that type of thing, there's no verb there. So you may be diagramming it something like this, where you have, you know, predicate nominative here, and the verb to be is understood. You just put an X there in that verb position. And that, of course, will help you preserve the integrity of your diagram as well, because if you don't have anything in here, it can be confusing as to what is what. If you just put your subject over here and then on the other side of the line put the predicate nominative in the position the verb normally went, that would be potentially confusing. So to preserve the system for the diagram, you just put an X in that position. There's nothing actually stated. And then put the other over here. Or you could put a form of the verb to be, I suppose. More likely, if it's not actually stated there in a situation like this, it's best to use the X there. And you'll see them commonly enough. Or if it's not a copulative verb, but it's a sentence structure in which, say, the first part, maybe there was two independent clauses, and the first clause used a verb, and the second clause had the same verb, but they didn't repeat it just because it was understood from the first one, then you can just put it in parentheses, put the same verb again in, because you know what it's supposed to be. Also, the antecedent of a relative pronoun sometimes is omitted. There may be a relative pronoun stuck in with no stated antecedent, and the antecedent may be a whole sentence, it may be a whole thought pattern. You know, sometimes, especially with neuter ones, the neuter pronoun may refer to a whole concept sometimes. And there are some other ways that the concept, if it's just in another sentence or something, there's another way to do that. But if there's no obvious thing that you can point to as the antecedent, you may use an X. Suppose you had a sentence structure where you had subject, verb, and then the direct object was some antecedent here to a relative. You had a relative pronoun down here, and the relative pronoun was stated, but the antecedent was the object of some other construction, and it wasn't stated per se. Certain in the context, you can put an X there. Or if you know from the context what the antecedent should be, you can put the antecedent parentheses. So just state the implied antecedent there. Okay. Then if connectives are omitted due to what's called asyndeton, there's a grammatical term here for... You might see some of these terms from time to time in the grammar book, so it's good to introduce you to them. Asyndeton means basically that you are omitting a connective and just not stating it. It's usually chi or something that's just not stated. And you put things together maybe with a comma. You know, this, and this. And asyndeton is just the lack of the use of a connective when it's understood. So, for example, let's take a typical example. Suppose we've got a prepositional phrase. We've got a preposition here, and it's got a double object or something. We've got a branch here, and we've got some noun here, and we've got some noun here. And you might have expected the chi there, but suppose the chi is not there. Then you put an X there. So that was, the X is, again, an omission marker. It's indicating that there should be a connector there, but there isn't. And so sometimes, you know, in English, we'll put a comma there sometimes to indicate that. And, of course, you might have a shelf here. A shelf will have a whole bunch of things stringed together. But having no connector. Okay. Questions there? Yes.
So in that form, you're going to have something written there one way or the other. So you just want to
right.
see the
yeah.
line.
Yeah, either you'll just put an X there or something, or you'll have a specific connector like chi or something, or Allah, or, you know, could be. There's other types of coordinating conjunctions that could be used. But if there's nothing there and it's obvious from the grammatical structure that there's a connection going on, best to put an X in there. Okay. Then another piece of information. This one you probably won't see very often. In fact, I couldn't find an example. He's diagrammed a good portion of Colossians there, and in looking at all of his diagrams there, I couldn't find an example of this one. So this one you may not see too often, but it's an ellipsis marker, something analogous to what we've been talking about here. An ellipsis marker is used when you have something bigger that's omitted that ought to go in a certain position. So it's represented by parentheses or dots. This indicates a word or phrase which are not present or which cannot be supplied from the immediate context. In other words, the immediate context doesn't tell you exactly what it is. It's not a situation where you have a verb missing because it was there in the previous clause and you know exactly what it is. But because of the structure, there ought to be something in there, but it's not stated in the immediate context. It may be understood from the whole flow of things, or it may be, in some instances, things are omitted for emotional impact. You know, sometimes things are stated and abruptly, and something is missing, and your mind is left to fill it in. This might be appropriate in cases where you have those oaths that are there given, like in Hebrews, where it's picking up from a Hebrew idiom, and there's a whole... And, you know, God do to me and more, if such and such, that whole phrase there is missing. You might use an ellipsis to put that in there in an exegetical type of thing so the person understands what's going on. So if suppose it was the subject of the verb, the direct object, you might have a subject verb. And you might have an ellipsis here indicating that something goes in there, something that's applied from the whole context, but it's not specifically stated and it's not... there in a few words in the immediate context. Sometimes you can include the words in parentheses if they're conjectured. In other words, if you can see what the concept is, you might go ahead and put the words in there rather than the ellipsis. It kind of depends on whether you're willing to commit yourself to what it is or not. In some cases, it depends on what you're trying to do, and if you're laying emphasis on that part, you might go ahead and put the words in. But you have to be careful when you do that, of course. Now, that's not going to happen too frequently, but apparently... happens enough where we need to set up a system for it. Yes?
When you brought that up, I was thinking, you know, if they shall enter into my rest.
Right.
So the ellipsis expression, you know, God should immediately know
right.
also, where would that go in a, you know, in this particular example, where would it go? Would that fill the whole subject verb space and then and you see, you know, that
yeah, it might fill
on a line and then...
Yeah, it might be, see, God do to me and more would be a whole sentence structure, basically, and it might be a whole independent clause, and you might have that whole thing in the ellipsis, and then dots down here to, or, you know, wherever this other clause fits the relationship to that, set up that. You might even set up a whole structure and then put the parentheses and dots in each position so that you can tell where your new thing is going to fit into. But in a case like that, you probably put the words in, maybe... Big parentheses around the whole thing or something, just to show that that is not part of the text.
Would we have time to take an example?
Yeah, we can if you want. We've got one.
2 Thessalonians 2:3. That day shall not come.
Okay, right. There's another good one. That day shall not come. That's a real good one. Yeah. Yeah. And, okay, 2:3. Yeah, what you have is kind of conditional that's picking up on a thought that's not really stated in the context, but the day has been spoken of and so forth. So that would be a good example, yes. That'd be a fun one. Maybe if we get some time later on, we ought to diagram that and just show the way this position would fit in. But in other words, this is a mechanism that's designed to handle situations like that where you've got a general context and you've been talking about something and you're not really repeating a phrase that might normally go in there, as long as the flow of the thought is still going to be preserved. Okay. Then a couple more things here before we're finished. An independent construction marker. This is a set of solid square brackets which enclose a grammatically independent thought placed in the middle of a sentence. It applies especially to genitive absolutes. And we've seen genitive absolutes before. And remember that the feature of a genitive absolute, apart from having a genitive participle and a genitive subject to the participle, was that nothing in the genitive absolute construction referred to anything, you know, had a specific antecedent in the rest of the sentence. And you see, this makes this genitive absolute construction an essentially independent construction. It's not tied to anything else in the sentence. In other words, we don't have any dotted lines that take, like with a subordinating conjunction or with a relative pronoun or something like that. We won't have any dotted lines that we can indicate to what it belongs to. It's generally adverbial. It's kind of modifying the whole, you know, while this was happening over here, this happened, that type of thing. And so to diagram that, we use an independent construction marker. This could also apply to nominative absolutes or some other. There's other more rare categories of things that this could apply to, but more often than not, it's going to be for genitive absolutes. So let's suppose we've got a sentence structure here with a subject and a verb and your direct object here. And let's suppose here, generally these are going to be adverbial, so we've got a genitive absolute construction down here, and the way to set that up, because of the participial construction, you put the noun or pronoun in the genitive up here, which is the subject of this genitive participle, then put the genitive participle here, and then if there's an object of the participle, put that here. You may take an object. And then put brackets around this entire thing. The dotted line here does tie it to the verb to show it's adverbial, but the brackets kind of sets this thing off as an independent expression. So this is an independent construction marker. And it's not really an independent clause because it's a participial phrase. So it's not going to be set up like an independent clause in a, you know, compound sentence or something. And it's not dependent. It doesn't have a subordinating conjunction or a relative pronoun or something that makes it dependent on the rest. So it's kind of in the category by itself. So this is what we use to just use these solid brackets around it to indicate that it's an independent construction. And I would say at least 90% of the time it's going to be with genitive absolutes that you're going to see this. Okay, and then the last one here is a phrase marker. This is a set of dotted square brackets used either vertically or horizontally. In other words, it kind of depends on what's convenient, but you can have dotted brackets like this going around something, or you might have them vertically, you know, if you've got something down here tied to something else. In other words, it's kind of a loose designation here, and since it's dotted, it's not carrying a lot of force itself. But it's indicating a multiple word antecedent of a relative pronoun in some instances. Suppose you've got a relative pronoun, and its antecedent is not just one word, but it's a whole phrase, or a number of words, or maybe a whole sentence. In those instances, you put in dotted brackets the whole thing that's the antecedent, and then put your dotted line from that system to whatever your relative pronoun is. Example, Colossians 1:29. let me show you here. Okay, let's see if this is real clear. Okay, what he's got down here, he's only got the brackets on one side here, but I guess you don't really have to have them on both sides of the thing. There's not much room here. But what he's got here is a relative pronoun down here, object of the preposition ace here, and then that dotted line going up to this bracket, which includes this whole hina clause up here. And that whole thing is the antecedent to this relative pronoun. Generally, the pronoun can be neuter in cases like this. The relative pronoun will be neuter because it's referring to a group of words rather than a single thing, a concept. So here's this dotted bracket here that's including this whole unit up here as the antecedent to this relative pronoun. And let's see, I think I had one more example too. Colossians 2, 16 and 17. Okay. Now this is a good one because it shows you what kind of problems you get into. In this case, we've got a relative pronoun down here in verse 17, ha esten, which is, and the which is referring to this whole modifying, all these modifying phrases that are modifying the verb up here. So he's got a kind of a funny looking bracket here that includes this whole thing up here. And then this neuter form down here is just including that whole unit. Yes?
Could give another example.
Go ahead.
Thinking about the addition 2, 8, and 9, this is not of yourself.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that
would be. This refers to a different.
It refers to that whole concept of justification by faith, yeah. And yes, that's a good point. Because if you try to nail that relative pronoun down to either the faith being not of yourself or, the grace, yeah, being not of yourself, it doesn't fit either one. And so it just ties into the whole concept. Yeah, that's a good example. So when you would diagram that, you would put a dotted line bracket around the whole thing that the relative pronoun is referring back to. Now, of course, there's going to be some instances where there's ambiguity. There may be a situation, for example, in which you have, normally this is going to happen with neuter relative pronouns, but suppose you've got a neuter relative pronoun, and the nouns that you happen to have in the previous context also include some neuters. There could be the potential of a problem in deciding whether or not it's referring to one of those neuter nouns, or whether it's referring to that whole concept. And so sometimes judgment's going to be involved there. Sometimes you may have to give a couple of options. This could be possibly this or possibly this, and then weigh those options in terms of parallel passages and so forth. Okay, so that one, let's see, Colossians 1:27 is another. Oh, yeah, there was another area. There's a multiple word phrase that a word or phrase in apposition further identifies or explains can also be done this way. Now, in one instance, we've got relative pronoun referring to an antecedent that's put in brackets. There's also the possibility of having one word in apposition to a whole concept. And in situations like that, you might find, for example, easiest way to diagram this. Let's suppose you have a whole sentence, a whole independent clause with a subject, verb, object, and that is placed in apposition to some other noun over here. Now, if of course this noun is in apposition to the object, you just diagram it this way. But suppose this noun is in apposition to the whole concept, then you put brackets around the whole thing. And now, this is now in apposition not just to the object here, but to the entire sentence. Or you could actually put this out front too, depending on what the space is. But the point is that you have a noun in apposition to a whole concept. Colossians 1:27 is an example of that.
There's a relative pronoun.
Let me check it here.
Isn't that the which that it talks about, which is Christ in you? The riches of the glory of the mystery of.
Oh yes, well yeah, the which is Christ in you is equated to hope here. There is a relative pronoun there.
Oh,
this one's got two things going on.
Oh.
You see, you've got the relative pronoun connecting you back up to mystery.
Yes.
But then, in addition, you've got which is the hope of glory. See, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. So the phrase Christ in you is equated to the hope of glory. It's in opposition to that, and it's also tied
to the previous.
If the hope of glory, is that in opposition to Christ, or is that in opposition to the whole thing?
Yeah, they're putting in opposition to the whole thing. Yeah. Well, he's diagramming it this way. See, this is where you might have to make a decision.
Yeah.
Because with opposition, you don't have the same advantage you do with a relative pronoun by using the right, you know, case and so forth, and gender.
Okay.
So, hey, Elpis could be conceivably in opposition to Christos, or it could be in opposition to the whole phrase. Okay. Did the bell ring yet? No, I guess it didn't.
Okay, it's the same thing. I'm wondering about the antecedent there, the riches and the glory of the mystery, which is in the nation. Is that entire phrase the antecedent to Christ in it? Or is it one of those aspects?
Okay, say that again now. Which portion are you?
Same verse.
Yeah.
John is asking about the hope of glory and how is that,
okay,
how is that related to the OSP? So I'm wondering, okay, what about Kuzov, Chase, Phil, Faith, and so on? Which one of those is antecedent to Christ in as far as that whole concept?
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, he's diagrammed it is referring back up to the mystery.
The mystery specifically.
Yeah, the mystery specifically. But, see, it is a neuter one. But see, here's a case where you might have the problem again, because the neuter could refer to the whole concept, or it could refer just to mysterium. Mysterium happens to be a neuter noun, so that's the first thing that they've gone to.
Although, but, could it possibly refer to tea?
Mm-hmm.
What?
And
that would include the entire thing.
Yeah, you could tie it to tea and really get it. Since that is, you know, conceptually, since the T is equated to Toplutos and so forth, you can really end up getting most of the entire last part of the sentence that way.
Theology.
Yeah, there's going to be theology involved. I mean, the fact that you diagram a sentence doesn't mean that you know everybody's going to diagram it the same way and you're going to solve all your problems. But what you do need to be aware of, once diagramming will help you see what options are available to you, and then you're going to have to do some other work to decide which is the best. Okay, let me give you a couple of ones to work on.